This is Penny Bell interviewing Fred Cowton for the Dialect and Heritage Project on Friday, the 26th of August, 2022. Fred, can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Charles Frederick Cowton.
And where and when were you born?
I was born here in 1942, October the 13th.
Which village are we in?
Borrowby.
Borrowby. So you grew up in Borrowby?
Yes.
And you live in the same house now?
I live in the same house that I was born in. Yeah.
Where did your parents grow up?
My father grew up in Thirlby. And my mother at Kepwick.
And how long have your family lived in Borrowby?
Well, my grandfather bought this house in 1929. So there's been a Cowton in this house from then till now.
Whereabouts did you go to school?
First of all, I went to Nathan School. That's the one just on the roadside between Borrowby and Nathan. It falls into Nathan because of it being the other side of the beck. So I went to the infants' school there, and then the junior school, and then I finished at Thirsk Grammar and Modern School.
Can you tell me about your school days? Did you enjoy them?
Not particularly. No, I really wasn't interested at that time. I regret it now. I should have paid more attention and done things better. If I had my time over again, I would do things differently.
Were there many students at the school, at the village school?
Yes, quite a number, because it drew pupils from the hillside villages as well, you know, such as Kirby Knoll, Silton, Nether Silton, Cowsby, and all that locality.
And you walked to school, did you?
Yes, well, until we got to go to Thirst School, and then we went by bus.
Can you tell me where you caught the bus? Was it a fun journey?
We had to walk down to the bottom of the village. And only one stop. And yet the bus passed the door, but it wouldn't stop for us. And we had to walk down there. And same in the evening when we got dropped off. We got dropped off at the same place, and we had to walk back up the hill every night.
Your father, can you tell me about the work your father did?
Well, he started out as a joiner, served his time as a country joiner with a chap called Joiner Lee, who was at Nathan, and he cycled from Thirlby to Nathan every day to work and back again in the evening. And then after that he started on his own here and built the workshop that you see standing here now and started up in business. He also served his time as an undertaker and a wheelwright. A wheelwright is a skill that was involved in making cart wheels, spoked wooden cart wheels with a steel hoop round the outside, and it's quite a skill really, because you've got to get everything right. The joints have to be tight in the centrepiece, and the hoop has to fit perfectly tight, otherwise the wheel would fall to pieces in no time.
And He made all of the wheel.
He made all except for the hoop, the metal hoop, yeah. What they call a centrepiece, where all the spokes go into, what you call the hub, they used to call them a felly. And the spokes were all shaped, you know, they weren't just round spokes, they were oval shaped. Mm-hmm. And they had to be fitted into the piece that, in half moon shaped, shape of the wheel, to form the base for the hoop to fit over.
And did
Am I explaining this all right?
Yeah. Did he fit the hoop even though he
yes,
didn't make
yeah.
it?
Yeah, he used to tell me about what they used to do when they got the wheel made. They used to put the hoop into a... Put it on fire bricks or something to keep just off the ground, and then light a fire underneath the hoop all the way around, like a ring of wood shavings and chippings, to heat the hoop up to a fairly high temperature, and they'd have the wooden wheel close by, and then they would lift the hoop out of the fire, and if it was expanded enough, it would drop over the top of the wooden wheel, and as it shrunk, it tightened it onto the wheel. That's how it stayed on. There was no fixings, otherwise it was just a shrunk on fit, so it had to be perfect.
That's fascinating. Did he repair wheels as well then?
Yeah, occasionally. I think he did get called in to repair them, but by the time he'd done a few here, Botherby, he moved on. He didn't, because the country joinery didn't pay very well. Too many small jobs, which he could only charge in those days a shilling for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like cutting a piece of glass for a henhouse, or putting a pane of glass in someone's back kitchen window that got broken, that kind of thing, and mending an old wheelbarrow that wanted a fresh board putting in the floor, you know, and these jobs that didn't pay.
Yeah.
You know, like making a coffin was the paid probably best of anything. But there's a lot of work goes into sawing out the boards and making the joints and making it up into a coffin, and then it all had to be scraped by hand with a hand scraper to get the finish on it, and then polished up so that it looked good, as coffins do, you know. And I mean, these days it's done by machines and such like, but that was all done by hand in those days.
Where did he get the timber from?
Well, he cut it out himself. He cut it out of the, you know, if he wanted an oak coffin, it would be cut out of an oak tree, a tree that had some clean wood in it. When I say clean, I mean free of knots, by and large. That's like the main part of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it cut those into probably inch thick, I would say, fairly thick boards. And then they were put aside with spacing lats in between so that the air dried gradually. And you were always working from stock. You had some ready to do and some that had just come in new, and they were drying out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did he paint the coffins? Or?
Oh, no.
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 Just polished?
Just polished. They were sealed inside with a sealant.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had to be... well, it used to have some sort of cloth put inside, and he had to get someone to do that for him, because he couldn't do that. It was a lady's job, a seamstress job, you know.
Wow. These coffins were mainly for the people of where?
Well, local people.
Very local.
Yeah. He got the job of making a coffin for my grandmother and various family members.
They did the same work, or they
It was the same kind of work, yeah.
Interesting.
I know my mother said that there was an auntie that was my grandmother's sister, auntie to my mother, and she died. He made the coffee for her and also my grandmother. I don't think he made the one for my grandfather, but by that time he'd gone out of it.
So village joinery didn't really pay,
no
the coffins,
no.
So what did he move on to next?
He moved on to contracting. He'd already got a tractor to turn his big rack bench that he'd made. That was to cut the coffin boards and anything else. And he'd been talking to his brother, my uncle Tom, at Thirlby, and he said, well, why don't you get a plough and you could come and plough me some land? So he thought, oh, well, I'll give it a try. And he did that, and I think by the time he'd got the field ploughed, someone else had come into the field and said, you could come and plough some for me if you've got time, you know. And so he said, oh, right, I'll do it while I'm here. And so that's how it started, you know, and it just went from one to another. And then, of course, war broke out in 1939, and he had lots of work then because farmers were under instructions from the war out to plough out pasture land and grow cereal crops to feed the nation. And it was pretty tough going, ploughing pasture land, which had never been disturbed for years and years. It was a hard job, and so the old tractor that he had wasn't up to the job, and that's when he got the Alice Chalmers tractor and put that to work. It was more powerful than anything he'd had before, and it was more powerful than, well, at that time, I mean, it could do things that horses just couldn't do.
So what year did he get the Alice tractor?
1939, right. Early part of 1939, just before the war broke out.
Right. He never farmed, though, before. He had nothing to do with horses. Or...
Well, only when he was at home, when he lived at home as a young
yeah.
a young boy, and he used to get all the rubbish jobs because his brother, was always the eldest, and he always got the best jobs. He used to ride up on the cart and drive the horse. And the father always had to, well, he was pretty peeved because he used to get sent to pick stones off the field, you know, and all the rubbish jobs like that. And then when he left school, his father said to him, you'll have to go out and get a job because I can't keep two of you at home. And so that was how he ended up going to Nathan to learn his trade as a joiner.
And apart from ploughing, did he do other contracting work?
Yeah, yes, it carried on from that, and he always had a yen to start threshing, and it was much against my mother's wishes. She didn't want him to start because she said, oh, you don't want to do that, it's a horrible, dirty job. But anyway, he went ahead and did it anyway, bought a threshing set. Well, it just developed from there, and he ended up buying another one. So he had two threshing sets for quite a number of years, right up until threshing died out and combine harvesters came in and took over. And he finished, I think he finished threshing in 1968 for the last time, because by that time it had got down to just an odd half day here and there. All the farmers wanted him for was to thresh a bit of corn so that they got some nice striped straw to touch the potato patch, and such as, like, you know, and it wasn't worth keeping it going.
No. What did you do after you left school?
Well, I'd always had a flair for doing cars and roll tractors as well, for that matter. Before I left school, I was taking tractors to pieces and putting them back together again, and playing about with the work vehicles. You know, when I say played about, pretty serious work, really. So I had a pretty good idea what I was doing, and my father was quite good with mechanical things, so I picked some of it up from him. And then I went and got a job working for a chap called Walker, who had a Vauxhall and Standard car agency down at Thirsk in Long Street. And I stayed there for about 3 years, and then things weren't going well. I wasn't happy with it, and I moved on. I moved up the road to another called James Swales. He was selling British Leyland BMC, as it was in those days. So I got something different to work on, and I was there for another 4 years. And then I moved on again, and I went to work in a Ford agency down at North Allerton. And I had 6 months off helping my father to lead. He had a lot of wood bought, and we bought an old army wagon and converted it into a log carrying wagon. But what called bolsters on each side, you know, to stop the round pieces of rolling off. And we were leading wood for 6 months.
Oh.
Put it in the wood yard, which is just down over the lane from where we live. And then after that, I went to work for a man called Jack Moore. They were dealt in motorcycles and cars, and hire cars and hire vans. And I was there for, I don't know, about 8 years. And then I left there and started on my own.
Doing
much the same thing,
yeah.
Servicing and repairing
yeah.
cars, bodywork, engine work, and, you know, everything really, rebars, new clutches, gearbox problems, brakes, MOTs. I didn't ever get the facilities to do MOT testing myself, because it needed some bigger premises and a lot more expenditure. So I used to prepare the tests and then take them and get them tested.
Mm.
And I did that right up to 1997.
And all the while, the Alice tractor from 1939, what had happened to that?
Ah, well, it was still getting used, because when we were collecting all the wood and doing that kind of thing, with having the winch on the back, we were using it all the time for pulling stuff out of the woods in difficult places. And fell in trees where they were leaning towards something like a building, so that we could cut it down and make sure that it came where we wanted it to fall, because, you know, it's so much top weight swaying it towards a property or a barn or something, and we could make sure that we could pull it over until it got past the point of falling the wrong way, and then it fell on its own. And I remember one particular scary one was a chap built a new bungalow at Boltby, and then he decided he wanted this big oak tree, which was right close to the bungalow, he wanted it taken down. So he said, asked my father if he could do it, and he said yes. He said, we'll take it down and take it away for you. And so he left it till the Saturday, when I was at home, because I was working all through the week. And we took the Alice and the chainsaw and the trailer and we felled the thing. We made sure that I was on the tractor when Father gave me the signal to pull it in, and I pulled it over and it dropped perfectly. And then we got the main of it on the trailer, and then we had to go back again for a second load. But we cleared it all up and no incidents happened. It was a bit risky really, because we had no insurance to cover it. But you're just confident that he could do it.
Yeah.
He'd done it plenty of times before. And so, yeah. So after that, after my father died, it was just standing, and well, I kept it undercover as much as I could. I kept it down at Thurskinner building for so long, and then that got sold along with the garden for a building plot, so I had to take it out of there, and I brought it up here, and it was standing at the bottom of the workshop for about 17 years until I had time to do it. And then when I retired, I got it out and started to work on it and restored it to what it is now.
Which is a, well, I've seen it, a beautiful tractor, yeah.
Yeah, well, the Alice Club that I'm in, when I took it to Newby Hall, they were swarmed all over it and photographing it and put it in the magazine and said, this is an Alice U, which has been restored by Fred Cowton immaculately. So I was quite pleased about that. And I've been taking it to shows ever since. So I've been taking it for about 11 years.
Do you enjoy that?
I do, really, yes. Yeah, I get to see a lot of other tractors and mix with like-minded people, which is always good. You get to go around on the parade round the ring. You get your half hour of going round, you know, and people there, you can see them with their long lenses, you know, focusing on the tractor. You knew that they were taking it. There must be hundreds of people with photographs of the Alice, because everywhere I go, they're out with their cameras and video cameras, you know, and taking the photograph.
Yeah. Oh.
And I've got trophies as well. I've got some quite good trophies. I've got some on here, but you won't want to see that.
Yeah.
And then I'd say I've done this Massey 35. I think this will be the last one I'll do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
This one is, it's a working tractor really, because I have a log splitter on the back.
Right.
And it's really useful. It said, well, I mean, I couldn't split some of the stuff. It needs to be powerful.
I'm going to ask you some questions about Borreby, if I can, Fred. Can you tell me if it's changed much during your lifetime?
Not as much as some villages, no. I don't think it has. We've got a lot of different people in the village, what it used to be, and they're different kind of people. They're what I would describe as more towny types, you know, that just want to live out in the country and commute to work from Borreby.
Mm.
Whereas it used to be that everyone knew everyone, and, you know, the old chaps would congregate in the pub and play crib or dominoes or something. You know, and it was like a better, closer community.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people lived in the village all their life and never really got to go anywhere. They had no car in those days. The mode of transport probably was a cycle, you know.
Mm. Mm. Was there any public transport in the village?
Well, there was in in my earliest memories, the buses used to run fairly well. We used to have a bus service to North Allerton and also down to Thirsk. And I remember my mother catching the bus on a Monday and going to Thirsk and doing the shopping. Mm. I used to have to go with her sometimes. And it's thoroughly boring. Then I used to stay at home sometimes because we had a good friend called Mrs. Harrison who lived at Heather Cottage now. And I used to go there sometimes. My mother would say, "Will you have him for this afternoon till I get back?" I'd say, "Oh yes, you bring him."
How did you, as a child, how did you spend your hours of freedom in the village?
Oh, well, I wasn't allowed to go out much in the village. I had a trike, which I used to ride round all over the place. That was one of my favourite things. I used to spend hours on that, pedalling it round. And I used to do all sorts of bits of jobs, busy myself in the garden a bit sometimes, help Grandfather Barnett, because he was living here in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quite a keen gardener. He used to grow vegetables and flowers and also bedding plants. And he used to take the bedding plants out and sell them to some of his friends up at Kempwick.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go with him. That was quite something because I got to drive the old car. It was funny, one day he was loading the car up and it was standing just outside here, and he was in the building getting some last things together, and I knew how to drive it, so I started it up and I drove it up to the top, onto the top of the hill. And when Grandfather came out of the building, he looked and he couldn't believe his eyes. The car had moved magically to the top of the yard. But anyway, I think he must have twigged on to what had happened. And ever after that, when we went somewhere where there's a gated road or something like that, he would get out and open the gates, and I used to drive up this track and back down again. And one in particular was, I don't know whether you know which it is, Carly's Farm.
Yeah.
We used to go up there. And, I loved that because it was a nice long drive and I could get up into second gear. I was only about 7.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh.
I started early. Well, I was driving the big Moorline tractor when I was 7.
Right.
Yeah.
Which tractor was that?
It was one that we used to use for sawing wood. It was an American tractor, same as the Alice. And it was a bit of a story to that, really, because my father was so pleased with the Alice when he'd had it for a bit, only a matter of months, but as I said earlier, there was such a lot of work came in during the war that he needed another good tractor, and so he ordered another Alice to come from America, and the order was accepted, and unfortunately the Germans sank it at Southampton. It was in the docks ready to be unloaded, and the Germans came over and bombed everything, and that was one of them, and there was a shipload of tractors went down and I was with them.
Oh dear.
Well, it happened, you know.
Yeah.
That's what happened. And so to make matters right, as far as they could, they sent him an MM, which is a Minneapolis Moorline. And he accepted that because you couldn't get tractors at that time.
Yeah.
And it came on spade lugs, whereas the Alice came on rubber tyres from the start. And the spade lugs were a real bind.
Yeah.
Because every time you finished a field, you had to put the roading bands on, and you had to clean all the caked on mud off the steel wheel and bolt these roading bands on. They were in sections, you see, and they had to be put on and bolted two nuts on each section to hold them on, and then you could go on the road, you see, because otherwise the lugs would have dug into the tarmac and made a horrible mess. So you weren't allowed to use the tractor on the road without these protective bands on.
Wow.
Anyway, that eventually got my father converted that onto rubbers. We got some different wheels for it and rubber tyres. And I remember the first time I drove it, I went with him because I always went like to go, and I saw him wood near the River Swale in a field there, and he said, well, I'd been just moving it about a bit, and he said, you can go anywhere you like round field with it, he said, as long as you don't drive into the River Swale. Keep out of there, don't go anywhere near the banking. So I did as I was told, because I did in those days, you know. And I had a bit of fun with it, driving it round, and then after that, I found out that I could manage it all right, because it was fortunate it had a hand clutch, and I could reach the hand clutch, whereas I couldn't with the Alice. It being a foot operated, I was too short in the legs. Even when I right at the edge of the seat, I couldn't press it far enough down. So another couple of years before I could manage to drive the Alice, which was very annoying because I wanted to drive it.
Oh, what else have I got? Can you tell me about any annual events you enjoyed as a child growing up in Borrowby?
Yeah, well, there used to be fun and games on the village green. And, you know, everybody could take part. There was things for the youngsters to do. And so that was quite good fun, and a party afterwards in the village hall. So yeah, that was quite something. And apart from that, there wasn't really very much to do. Mix with the lads a bit, but it was really, apart from riding bikes down the back lane and such as that, there wasn't really much you could do.
Did you get involved with the show at all? Or?
Well, yes. I used to put my handwriting into the show, into the Borrowby show. Because the school children couldn't, there was a class for handwriting. I entered that. I didn't get any prizes. And my father, he used to show his honey, being a beekeeper.
Oh.
He used to take honey to the Borrowby show.
Where did he keep his bees?
Round the back of the building here. In what was the orchard in those days?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you ever help with the honey? Or?
Yes, I used to help him extract the honey, because the extractor had to be wound with the handle, and it used to spin round, and the honey used to be forced out of the combs, and it hit the insides of the extractor and then ran down into the bottom. So, yes, he used to get me on doing that, because he would be taking the cappings off. He used to have to take the cappings off with a hot knife. He used to have a jug of boiling water to put the knife in, and then take the capping off the comb, because the bees seal it over with what we call a capping. That's to stop the honey leaking out.
Mm.
So, in order to get it to come out, you had to take the capping off and then put the combs into the extractor, wind it round, and then when you'd done one side of them, you had to stop the extracting, lift them out and turn them over and put them in the other way up, and then spin it round again till you got both sides emptied.
Did most people, well, keep honey in Borrowbee, keep bees, or?
Yeah, there was a chap called Rowlands. He actually was quite good, because my father, being a new starter, needed a bit of help to how to do things. And when he was away, if there was a swarm went out, I used to have to run down the village, because Mr. Rowlands was up in the gardens, away from the village, actually, had gardens.
Oh.
Where...
Browns.
Well, it's where Newburn is now. You know where...
Yes.
Well, Margaret...
Yeah, Margaret Moseley.
Moseley lives up
yes.
there.
Yes.
Well, near to there, he had all that in garden.
Oh.
And he used to keep his bees there. And so I used to run down and say, "There's a swarm, Mr. Rowlands." "Right," he used to say, "I'll be up in a minute." And he was lame, poor chap. But he used to come, he always walked on his toe with one foot. Couldn't seem to put the foot down properly. He used to come limping up and take the swarm, put it into a straw skep, and then put it down on a board, which my father had a nice running up board for running them back into the hive. And it would stay there once they were in there, and as long as you got the queen yeah. in there, you made sure that you captured the queen, and then the bees would follow, a bit like sheep really. They all clustered around her to protect her, you see. And it would wait there until my father came, and he would, because what you had to do, a swarm is always caused by having two queens. If a new queen hatches out, it's like having two women in the kitchen. They won't agree. You've got to get one of them out, you see. And so what you do is you go through the hive and you take out the old queen and kill it off. And then you put the swarm back in with the new queen, and then they're all set for the rest of the season.
Mm.
But if you lose the first swarm, you've lost a lot of your working bees, and it seriously reduces the strength of the stock and reduces the chance of getting a good crop of honey.
Right.
So he learnt all this from Mr. Rowlands, you see, and I picked it up as well. And so... I've been known to go and take a swarm.
But you don't have hives of your own now?
No, because I found out I managed to do without getting stung when I was taking these swarms. But I found out in later years that if I got stung, it affected me badly. It affected my chest and breathing, even if I got stung on the hand.
Mm-hmm.
Because one time, during hay time, I was servicing the baler, the hay baler, and working down here, and my father was going through a stock of bees, or so many bees round the back, and they were so angry that came and stung me. Not even, because he had his veil on, you know, covered over, and he had his gloves on, and he was alright, but I got the full brunt of it. And one time I got stung quite badly, and I felt awful. I thought I was going to pass out. And I was sitting in the front room in the cool, because it was a hot sunny day, rather sultry, and that had a bit to do with them being angry, because they can sense thunder miles away. And I was sat there, and I was having trouble breathing, and my father came in, and he saw just what I was like, and he said, in future, he said, "You'll have to keep away from him." He said, "It's not going to agree with you."
Mm.
So after that, I had to put a veil on when I was working in the yard here.
Oh!
Because I had to get on and do these things, you know, grease it up and do the oil levels, and so I kept working away, but I had this veil on while I was doing it, and he was doing the bees, because he was an enthusiastic beekeeper, he got up to 20 some hives.
Wow.
So there was a lot to do.
And the orchard that they were in, does that still exist?
Or? No, because most of the trees got old and one by one they got knocked down or fell down. Yeah. So, yeah, they've all gone. What there is in trees now are what has been planted. Apart from there's a Bramley apple tree which has been there as long as I can remember. But the rest of them, there's a plum tree and such like that I've planted.
Mm.
But there used to be a lot of trees around here because this place was a market garden at one time before my grandfather bought it. And the orchard up there was covered in plum trees and crabapple trees and fruit trees, you know.
It's a good area, is it, for apple trees?
Seemed to do all right, yeah. Because
yeah.
There's a market gardener used to live here, a man called Smith, and he used to take the crops and go to market and sell it.
And next door, did they do the same?
They might have done. I remember there was a vast collection of trees in that orchard where those houses are now.
Mm.
But it fell into rack and ruin because an old chap lived there and he never bothered with it. After his wife died, I think he lost all interest in it.
Mm.
And of course the trees got knocked down to put the houses on.
Mm.
How are we doing?
We're doing very well. It's all very interesting. Did you keep any livestock at all?
Yeah, I used to keep some pigs. Yeah. We had an old corrugated building right at the top of the orchard at the corner nearest the road, and a pen, and we used to keep a couple of pigs in there, get them fattened up and then kill them and add the bacon from them.
And
yeah.
Any poultry or birds?
No, I never had any chickens or anything like that. Just the pigs.
And for Christmas dinner, what would be on the table?
Didn't have any geese or anything like that.
No.
Not that I can remember. I remember us having them, but they usually came from some farmer where my father had been working, and you know they would have one that he could buy from them.
Mm-hmm. I'll move on to the next part of this. In 1951, as part of the survey of English dialect, five men in Borrowby were interviewed. They were John Morton, Matthew Morton, Fred Kirk, Jack Kidson and Harry Barnett. Do you remember any of these men?
I do, yeah. I remember Fred Kirk, because I once got asked to have a look at his motorcycle. There was a problem with the gear selecting, and I sorted that out for him, and I was only in my teens. Yeah, he had a lovely Norton, and that was the one I fixed for him. I got to ride it out when I went to test it. I'd never ridden such a big bike before, and it was a lovely bike. It was his pride and joy.
Where did he live?
Just down in what's called Britain's Row in Borrowby. That's just below where the Mortons used to live.
Mm.
Mm.
And Harry Barnett?
Harry Barnett, well, as I say, he farmed at Kepwick Mill. He was a tenant farmer at Kepwick Mill and also a miller. Ran the water wheel and the mill. and then after my gran died, he more or less became homeless because his son took over and his wife didn't want the old man and more or less chucked him out. And so he came down here to live with my mother.
And just to clarify, his relation to you, he is your...
grandfather.
Yes.
Yes.
Can you tell me about your memories of your grandfather?
Yeah. Well, he was a no-nonsense sort of a man, as you can see from the photograph. He looks quite stern.
Mm.
But there was two sides to him. He could be quite okay. He was always pretty okay with me, but he was horrible to my mother at times. Really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
He never wanted her to marry my father. He did everything he could to stop it. Even to refuse my gran to go to the wedding, he stopped her going. Yeah, that's true.
Oh dear.
That was an awful thing to do.
Yeah.
And what's more, he was so annoyed with my mother because she was getting married and leaving, he told her never to darken the doorstep again.
At Capwick.
Mm.
And then he came and lived.
And then, a few years later, he ended up having to come here, and I don't know why they did after the way he treated them, but they took him in because he was homeless. Young Harry's wife threw all his belongings out into the barn and made it quite clear to him that she did not want him there.
I wasn't expecting this. Oh, as a child, though, did you enjoy having your grandfather living with you?
I didn't have much feelings about it, really, but I can always remember if I got a bit noisy, he used to say to me, and not just once, but plenty of times, he used to say, a little boy should be seen and not heard. And he was always drumming that into me. And I didn't quite know what to make of him.
And did he do the vegetable garden here?
Yes,
then?
He did, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any problem with,
I used to go in and pinch the peas as he grew when he wasn't looking.
How did he cope with slugs and pests and, just general challenges of growing vegetables in the countryside?
Well, he seemed to get results. I don't know. I don't know what he used as regards stopping pests. I didn't bother myself about it, really, because I just liked helping myself to the peas when they were there. I remember him, he used to grow sweet peas, and he used to give them to people, some people. And as I say, there was two sides to him. He could be quite all right with some people. I mean, there's some people in the village that he befriended, and he used to go visiting. He used to go and take something, knock on the door, and just ask him in, and he'd spend the night with them there, then come back when it was 10 o'clock. They always went to bed at 10 o'clock, on the dot. Always had done at Kirkwood, and he still did when he was living here.
And what time did he get up on the morning?
Oh, he was always up by about 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
Mm.
When they interviewed your grandfather, he would have been selected because he had strong dialect,
mm-hmm.
I think. Do you think
I've still got it?
Well, do you think you have
I don't know.
And do you think the local dialect has changed?
When I hear myself, when it's being recorded, I hardly recognise myself.
Your grandfather's and your parents' way of talking, would it be different to how you speak now, do you think?
I can't really say that it's all that different. I mean, it's a long time ago, and I can't really remember what Grandfather Barney's. I mean, I could understand him well enough, so I don't remember anything particularly about it.
When they questioned him, they had a series of books that they went through where they asked the people they were interviewing, what do you call this, what do you call that? And they asked him on the book about nature,
mm-hmm.
the book about house, the house and housekeeping, and the human body. And there's one diagram where he's named the parts of this. So if you recognise my drawing, what would you call that?
Are we talking about the human body?
No, no. This is in the countryside. It'd be to get from one field to another, you go through the...
Oh, the gate?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he named these different parts of the gate.
It's funny, the top looks... I thought it looked like a gas cylinder.
My drawing. So... He had words for like these strips of wood that went down.
Oh, that struts.
Yeah, he called them daggers.
Daggers?
Hmm. And this.
Well, yeah, I suppose if they end in a point at the top.
Oh, you might call them.
That would institute calling them a dagger. I've done that when. Well, I mean, I made that front gate. And that's got daggers, pointed top. Yeah, but the strut is the piece that goes across to stop the gate sagging down.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you see them put an extra one in back to the heel as a stiffener or a strut.
What did you call that one?
That's the king post, isn't it?
And you said back to the heel. Which is the heel?
Well, the heel, yeah. I suppose the heel is the lower part of the main frame, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the head, the swinging part.
Interesting. I'm not going to ask you about parts of the human body or the words
that
they actually
are.
No. So if there's do you have any other like particular memories you think would be interesting to record, or I can move on to the next part, which is I think
as a child that looking back on it, I led a very sheltered life. I didn't get out and mix very much until I was quite a lot older. I used to go to Thirsk on a Saturday night when I got about at school, just before school leaving age. But until then, I was always sort of around here and with my father going places or doing things. Because he was, well, you might say he was a workaholic, because he never had any holidays. He never had a holiday since his honeymoon. And so he was always busy in the workshop or outside doing something or going out to jobs, you know, or we'd be doing something to a tractor or a threshing machine or something needed repairing or maintenance. I learnt a lot from being with him because we did all sorts of different jobs, you know.
And your mother? We haven't mentioned your mother. What did she do, mainly?
Well, she used to busy herself making things. She used to make jams and such as that, you know, and apart from the routine housekeeping duties,
yeah.
Used to do knitting. And at one time she was doing a bit of rug making. She used to clip rugs for going in front of the fireplace and that kind of thing. I mean, you wouldn't think of using such a thing now, I know, but used to make it out of old clothes, you know, used to cut the old clothes up into strips and then you got like a framework and you used to have a hook that you pushed it piece of material through and then pull the other end back up, you know,
in a loop, that tied it and pulled it tight, and then you just clipped the top off so it was all level.
Hmm. Lovely.
I remember having that on her name, doing that.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, and across her music, not forgetting that, my mother was a trained soprano singer, alto soprano.
Where did she sing?
Anywhere. I mean, she used to go out to events, you know, they'd invite her to go and sing at Irish festivals or some occasion.
Right.
And my father used to take her. That's one time when he had a night off, he would go and take her. And
where was she trained?
She trained with a lady in South Parade at North Allerton. And she used to have to cycle there every week for her lesson. She had a piano lesson and singing lesson. And Grandfather Barney's had a car, but he never got the car out to take her. He'd see her go on the bike first.
From Kepwick?
From Kepwick, right down to North Allerton, on all weathers.
All year round?
All the year round.
Heavens.
I often think now, what an awful time she must have had, because the best route would probably be down Crockliffe Bank.
Yeah.
And out to North Allerton. But you know, to get from Kepwick to there, it's quite a roundabout way, because it's not a direct route.
Yeah.
You face it going towards Silton and then coming back over to Stell Bank, and then down Crockliffe, and out onto North Allerton Road.
Wow.
Or else come this way, past here. But I think she would go the top way down the Crockliffe Road.
Hmm. I suppose the roads wouldn't have been as busy, but.
So she enjoyed her music and singing and playing the piano. She played the organ at Barnaby Chapel for years and years. She got a job there, which she landed into it and then couldn't get out of it. You know, no one would take it on, and she thought, well, I can't say I'm stuck. I'll have to keep doing it, but there were times when she wanted to be away and do something different.
Yeah.
But it was a time thing, really, every Sunday night.
Yeah. Did you go to chapel?
I did have to go, until I rebelled and said I'm not going anymore. When certain preachers used to come, some of them used to actually come here and leave their car, and they used to come into the house, and they used to stay for supper sometimes, some of them. And they used to pressure me and say, before the service, are you coming, Fred, you know? And I said, no, I don't think I will. Oh, go on, you'll enjoy it. And I thought, no, I won't. Anyway, eventually they stopped asking.
So, this part of the interview is about dialect a bit more. We've got some picture prompts that I'll show you, and you just need to tell me what you would call it. What do you call this creature?
Hedgehog.
What do you call these?
A spider.
Have another look.
Oh, a dragonfly. Yeah?
Yeah. What about these?
Well, that's a beetle, isn't it?
It's quite a large photograph of this beetle. Mm. I think you might have another name for that particular beetle. If you imagine it a bit smaller than that.
Not a wood lice, is it?
No, it's the other one.
Not a wood worm?
No.
No. Oh, an earwig. Of course it is. I tell you what was the funny thing. My grandfather used to grow chrysanthemums. And he used to put a flower pot on the top and the earwigs used to go up into it. I should have known that. And I used to go around taking the plant pots off and killing the earwigs, because that's what he said I had to
do. Yeah, yeah. They're renowned for it with the chrysanthemums. What do you call this type of garden weed?
Rubbish.
I'm not sure what it's
supposed
to be.
Can you see which one it is? It's the one that's in the hedge back. That.
Not a dandelion, is it?
No. It does stick to you. It's the one that grows all over the hedges.
Oh, well, nicknamed Sweetheart, isn't it? I don't know what its proper name is.
Okay.
Yeah, it's right clinging stuff, isn't it?
Mm. This is a drop of...
It looks like a drop of water.
Mm. On a morning, on a blade of grass.
Dew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the word I wanted, thank you. And this is a bag of...
Oh, we just got jelly babies, I think. Am I right?
Yeah, or just a more general term for...
Well, all sorts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is no wrong or right answer. It's just It's just what people call things.
I never ate a lot of sweets, really. I still don't.
What do you call one of these?
A bread bun.
Mm-hmm. And what do you call these?
Is it a type of scone?
Yes.
Yeah. I recognise it.
But you would call it a scone.
A scone.
That's the word. Yeah.
Call it a scone.
Yeah.
Yes.
But that was the word we wanted. Can you count how many are in the picture?
Well, it looks like three.
Yeah. That's good. If there was one more than three, what would you say?
What, you mean another name for four?
No, just how you say the word four. So you said
a
four.
Quad?
Four. That's it.
Oh, right.
Four.
Well,
it's all about pronunciation, and that's all they're after. They just...
Right.
What's your word for...
They're not very good at that.
No, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. What's your word for these?
They're shallots, aren't they?
Can be.
They're like small onions.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what's this?
Looks like a courting couple.
Yeah. Can you see what they're doing? She's giving him a...
Oh.
I think it's a difficult photograph to see.
I don't know whether she's hugging him or...
She's carrying him.
Giving him a... Well, it's not...
She's carrying him on her back.
Well, it's not a piggyback, is it, really?
Yeah, it is. That's
doesn't
the word.
Look at all like that.
No, I agree with you. And what do you call this?
A seesaw.
Yes. Thank you. So... Now I have two sentence prompts where I'm going to ask you to read the sentence and fill in the gap.
He asked me to fix it and...
And then you go in there.
I said,
Yes, I think
that's appropriate, isn't it?
And I think that is what you've been saying when you've been talking. So that is what you would say. The food was...
The food was...
I'm kind of looking...
Can you use two of these?
Yeah, words? Whichever words
well,
you would use.
It's tasty then. No.
The food was... If it was... It was tasty, but how tasty was
it? Oh, well, proper.
Proper tasty.
Proper tasty, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. And now I just have some questions that I'll ask you and you just answer. What do you call a room in a house for storing food?
With what?
What would you call a room in a house for storing food?
Oh, a larder.
If you haven't eaten any food for a long time, you're bound to feel...
Ravenous.
What words do you use for something to eat?
For something?
To eat.
To eat. What word do you use for something to eat? Well, starving.
Or to describe the actual what you're going to eat.
Oh.
What word do you use for something to eat?
What, grub?
That's good. What do you call a coffee you might get from a cafe with lots of milk in it?
A milky coffee.
Yeah. What's the dairy product that you spread on toast and sandwiches?
Well, it used to be butter, but nothing anymore, really, is it?
You do, don't you have a butter anymore?
Well,
no.
It's spread, isn't it?
Oh,
isn't it?
I have butter still.
Oh, this is supposed to be very bad for you.
I love butter. Which word or phrase would you use to indicate a temporary break in a game when points cannot be scored?
Pause.
Okay. If you fall over in the playground, your knee might be...
Scrubbed.
If you got covered in dirt at the playground, when you get home, you might need to get in the...
The bath.
When children are very excited, you might say they are full of...
Beans.
At the end of a long and tiring day, you'd say you were absolutely...
Worn out.
Which word would you use to mean not attending school?
Truancy.
Sometimes when children are being very naughty, their parents tell them that someone will come and take them away. What do you call this mysterious person?
Oh, bogeyman.
You grow crops and raise animals on a...
Farm?
Yep. When you walk in the countryside after heavy rain, your shoes will get covered in...
Mud.
When driving in icy or wet weather, you must take care because the roads are...
Slippery.
Which word do you use as a term of endearment, even with strangers?
Pleased to meet you.
Which word would you use to refer to someone as very attractive?
Bonnie?
What is your word for spreading rumours?
Malicious gossip.
A picture not hanging straight is hanging...
Crooked.
What do you call a very small piece of wood that has got into your finger?
A spelt.
What do you call a person who mends shoes and boots?
Cobbler.
And do you have any other words you'd like to tell us about?
Really?
No. I think that's too difficult to think of on the spur of the moment. Well, I think that's it. Thank you very much, Fred. That's been really interesting.
Cross Keys. Did I wear Cross Keys? That the last house going out of the village before you get to Lake Crossroads there. You know where Lake House is?
Oh, Dr. Paul.
The one that's on the left, down in that...
Yes.
In that low part of the field.
So that's where Harry Barnett was born.
Yeah, Grandfather Barnett was born, yeah. Mm-hmm. And how he started out, digging ditches out and slashing hedges. And he must have done that until he got sufficient money together to pay for the rent on Kepwick Mill for a term. I'm only guessing at this, but I think, you know, the way he counted his money, he'd come by hard work, but he made sure that he had an easy time of it once he got established at Kepwick Mill, because a lot of time, like for instance, my mother had to go and do the milking every night and morning. And young Harry was supposed to help her on a Sunday, because they both wanted to be off. But Harry used to skip out of it and leave my mother with it all, which is rather naughty.
Mm.
And she had to rush through it all and then cycle to meet my father. He used to meet her about halfway. And sometimes he would cycle all the way up to Kepwick. He used to go up to Kepwick church, because my mother used to like to go there. She used to walk up from Kepwick Mill up to Kepwick
mm-hmm.
for Sunday service.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember her saying she was pursued by a man that was fancying his chances, and he was getting a bit too close and a bit too friendly, and she really stepped it out. She went so fast that he couldn't keep up with her. She was a good, strong walker in those days. And she, you know, shrugged him off because she didn't want anything to do with him. He just didn't appeal to her at all.
Oh,
but he was a one for pursuing.
This is your father? Or someone else?
Oh, someone else.
Someone
not the father.
Right.
Oh, no, she didn't push him away.
No, no.
Mm. And the funny thing was, Grandfather Barnett thought my father was okay because he could join her and do things for him. And he thought that he was going to see Harry, his son, you know, younger Harry. He thought it was his pal. Things only went wrong when he found out it was my mother he was after, not Harry. You can imagine, can't you?
And did, when he moved from Cross Keys, were the rest of his family still at Cross Keys? Or?
I don't know really what happened to them.
Yeah.
No. I only remember him saying about starting from Cross Keys and how we started out edging and ditching. That would be a pretty rotten job, wouldn't it, really?
Mm, horrible.
People don't do it these days.
No.
You're standing in water, you know, and digging it out, and then having to slash the hedge. Could be in an awkward place. It could be 1 foot in the ditch and one on the banking.
There would be hawthorn mainly, would it?
Yeah, I think there would be, yeah.
What do they do with the
clippings, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, the slashings. Well, they used to heap it up into heaps, and then I think they burnt it in the field.
Mm. Lots of spelks.
Yeah,
you call
prickly
them.
Bits.
Yeah, thorns.
Yeah, thorns.